you can kind of put them into two categories. One category is what I would call one creation theology, where God would give us, or no God, we would have just the one universe and whatever future we have would lie in that universe, contrasted with Christianity, which provides us with a two creation model, a universe that God creates to bring about the rapid, efficient conquest of evil, and then a universe or a creation beyond the universe, which we get to enjoy fellowship with the Creator, where evil will no longer again raise its ugly head without in any way disturbing humanity's capacity for free will and free choice. Well, this latest issue of Icarus looks into the subject of supereruptions. And these are volcanoes, but not little volcanoes, really big volcanoes. And the supereruptions, by definition, are those volcanoes that will throw into the atmosphere 1,000 cubic kilometers of material or more. So just think about that, 1,000 cubic kilometers of stuff. That's a lot of stuff. And that's just the rocks and the stones. In addition to that, a super eruption will throw into the atmosphere 1,000 million tons or 1 billion tons of dust and aerosol material, so dust particles, micron dust particles into the atmosphere. What paper does is it, number one, calculates what the impact of this super eruption would be on the human civilization, or for that matter, any kind of civilization, because the paper is really trying to critique the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's the main goal of the paper, trying to make the point that extraterrestrial intelligence civilizations, if they exist at all, must be extremely rare. And one of the points it makes in the paper is that you can't have anything like human civilization or an intelligent physical species capable of developing civilization unless you've got super eruptions. And the reason for that is advanced physical life is not possible without long-lasting, strong plate tectonic activity. Without that plate tectonic activity, there will be no capacity for the planet to compensate for the changing luminosity in its star. All stars in our galaxy, during their stable burning phase, get brighter and brighter as they get older and older. And its plate tectonic activity on planet Earth, in combination with the creation of the just right life forms at the just right times, that remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and convert them into sand and carbonates in the crust of the Earth. That's been going on literally for the last 3.5 billion years. Life working in concert with plate tectonics to remove the greenhouse gases, so as the sun gets brighter and brighter, the atmosphere becomes progressively less and less efficient to trap heat. And given that advanced life requires a significant quantity of biodeposits, and you know, sand and carbonates are things that we use to sustain our civilization. More than that, this burial mechanism also puts coal and oil and natural gas into the crust of the Earth. And so advanced life would not be possible unless this kind of mechanism is going on for a long period of time. But if that mechanism is going on for a long period of time, you're going to have a planet which will have super eruptions. Then the second thing this paper does is calculate what a single super eruption would do. And the bottom line is, it puts an end to any kind of possible civilization on the planet. The release of this much particulate matter in the atmosphere and the ejection of that many rocks and stones into the atmosphere will result in conditions that will make advanced life not possible on planet Earth. Now, the paper does point out that if you've got some really savvy, intelligent beings, they might be able, in the knowledge that such a super eruption is going to come, dig a really deep hole into the crust of the Earth and make a little cavity there where they could kind of wait out the consequences. But the consequences last for hundreds of years. And therefore, it's necessary that you've got a few people living in this cavity, and the dense, and they'd have to be lucky enough to actually put it in a spot in the Earth where the super eruption would not destroy that little cavity that they got in the crust. In fact, the paper actually goes into discussing that it might be a good idea for human civilization right now to prepare a few of these refuges in the crust of the Earth so that if a super eruption is imminent, we can send a few volunteers. And, you know, that's kind of a problem. Who do you put into those little holes? And, you know, could they even survive in those holes? And, you know, one comment they make is there's a physical issue surviving in one of these little cavities in the crust of the Earth, but there's also the psychological issue. Is it really possible that the equivalent of human beings that are capable of launching civilization could survive for hundreds of years in a small enclosed cavity thousands of feet below the surface of the Earth and retain any semblance of sanity or any possibility that they could possibly survive? And he also made note of the fact that the birth rate might drop and that the people in the cavity could simply go extinct before the conditions are safe. And so they make a powerful case that a likelihood of an intelligent species surviving such an event are quite remote. If they do survive, they're going to be surviving at an extremely low population level without the benefit of technology, and you basically got the problem that you would have with the human species 50,000 years ago, that it would take tens of thousands of years for that species to regain any global civilization on the planet. That's how long it took Adam and Eve to get us to the point we are today, and it would take that long again. Now that raises a problem, because the last thing they do in the paper is they calculate how frequently these super eruptions will occur on the face of the Earth, or any planet like the Earth. Not just the Earth, but any planet like the Earth that would be capable of possibly sustaining an intelligent, advanced civilization. And the answer is at least once every 50,000 years. So if it takes 50,000 years for humanity to get to the point where it is today, and these things happen every 50,000 years, they wind up concluding that perhaps we're wasting a lot of valuable telescope time and a lot of taxpayer dollars and a lot of Paul Allen's money looking for extraterrestrial intelligent life. Now, that's where the paper ends. The paper doesn't go any further than that. But I think all of you can see that there's a much more significant issue that's raised in this piece of research. Why are we here? I mean, if conditions are like that on planet Earth, and you know these things happen every 50,000 years, we must be extraordinarily fortunate to have not had any of these super eruptions within our human existence here on the planet. And maybe we shouldn't count on being here too much longer before another one hits. Now, one thing the paper does get into is where is the greatest likelihood of these super eruptions happening in, say, the next few thousand years? And the answer is the highest probability of all is North America. So being a U.S. citizen is probably the most risky thing of all, because the two highest risk sites are number one, Yellowstone, and number two, Mammoth. Okay? And so, you know, if either one of those goes, the 48 contiguous states are gone. So, they're gone. As they point out, it wouldn't just be the end of American civilization, it would be the end of human civilization. Because a super eruption would have global consequences, but would have relatively immediate consequences for those of us living in the 48 contiguous states. So, but I think what I'm excited about is this piece of research really gives strong support for the biblical message that God has created this universe and this planet to provide a brief home in which we can exist, whereby God can bring about the conquest of evil, and when evil is conquered, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose, and as the Bible promises, the moment that evil is finally reconquered and removed, God will immediately replace this universe with a brand new creation. a very different creation, for super eruptions will never happen, period. So they will never get to see a super eruption here on planet Earth, because God is bringing about the conquest of evil relatively quickly. And this actually ties into our study today, based on Psalm 33, that God is in complete control over not just the physical creation, but also over human history. And his plan is to bring about this conquest of evil relatively quickly, rather than waiting millions of years. And if this paper is any indication, we're looking at hundreds of years or thousands of years or less, given the fact that these super eruptions occur as frequently as they do. And you know, the last thing that's in this paper is they say super eruptions rank as the highest risk for the end of human civilization. We've been worrying about an asteroid possibly colliding, or maybe a comet colliding with the Earth, and or a supernova eruption taking place, and a point where, you know, a gamma ray burst. And indeed, these kinds of events would bring about the end of human civilization. But they said this is by far the highest risk that humanity is facing today in terms of something, a natural event, that could bring about the end of a civilization on a global basis. In fact, they say this is twice as likely to happen as any other combination of natural disasters combined. And therefore, this is the one thing that we should be preparing for. But the only thing they could suggest was making these little boxes that we put in deep underground mine shafts, and just hope that the super eruption doesn't blast that apart. And, you know, with the hope that maybe human beings could maintain their sanity living in such a place. And one thing they said is, we don't even know it's possible that you could sustain for a long period of time human beings in such an environment. Another option they mentioned, of course, is that you get a, quote, few volunteers and put them up in the space station. But I think we all know that the space station really isn't adequate to sustain human beings for a long period of time. And you get the same psychological issue. You put a bunch of people up in a small spaceship for hundreds of years. Is there any guarantee that they're not going to bring about their own extinction by their inability to maintain any sense of sanity? Yeah, question. Yes, I mean, maybe not total darkness, but it would bring about the end of photosynthesis, which is bad news, because if you don't have photosynthesis going on, you have no food production, and without food production, humanity rapidly dies. So that's the main thing they bring out, is that the atmosphere becomes so dust-filled, number one, it wouldn't be able to breathe well. So you'd have a lot of people dying, 30 quick deaths from respiratory conditions, if the boulders don't get them first. And then, you know, if the boulders don't get them and the respiratory disease doesn't get them, then the lack of food is going to set in. And you're going to be without food for a long, long time. And which is why they're talking about maybe putting some people up in a spaceship or some people on the ground. But now you got the problem of how you're going to grow food there underground. And you also have to be able to preserve an atmosphere that the people can breathe for hundreds of years. And so far, experiments that have been done with trying to keep people in closed systems have shown us that we're not able to pull it off. Some of you may have, in fact, I think it's now a tourist attraction. You can go a little bit north of Tucson, and you can visit what's called the biosphere. And that's been the most sophisticated experiment to try to sustain human life inside some kind of enclosed capsule. It's 7 acres, so it's a fairly big facility, but the longest they've been able to sustain people in there without cheating is 6 months. And what I mean by cheating is you put a bunch of people in there and you can't keep the atmosphere just right, so you have to keep pumping in fresh supplies of atmosphere. What I thought was most amusing about the three biosphere experiments that have been done in all three cases, there was severe psychological collapse. Now, that's the term they put in the scientific literature. What was really going on is that they were getting into malicious fights, such that they had to remove certain individuals from the capsule. So, I mean, you can just think about it. Think about taking a long drive with a bunch of little kids in a small van. Okay? Right. Or for that matter, put a bunch of adults in and see how long they last. So, I remember when our kids were little, 3 hours is the limit. You had to let them out. So, yeah. Well, these are all options, you know, going to the moon, going to Mars, going to outer space, going underground, maybe the bottom of the ocean. That's all been discussed. The problem with trying to go to the bottom of the ocean or underground, you really don't have any guarantee that the super eruption wouldn't destroy the facilities that you've prepared. So in one sense, going to outer space is a little more viable, because at least you can get away from the thing you're trying to protect civilization against. But the problem in each case is, how do you keep intelligent life alive for the necessary period of time in a small enclosure? And you know, the smaller the enclosure, the more subject that those people are to an ecological collapse. And in all three of the biosphere experiments, there was an ecological collapse, such that it threatened the life of the occupants, and they had to pull them out. And so, I mean, it's hard enough trying to maintain an ecological balance on planet Earth. Trying to take something significantly smaller than planet Earth and trying to keep it ecologically balanced so that you got the right atmosphere, the right nutrients, and the right amount of safety factors. See, the planet Earth is designed in such a way that if we human beings mess up, it tends to work out fine. Or if you want another experiment, think of Easter Island. A few people moved to Easter Island, and after a few hundred years, they had an ecological collapse because they cut down all the trees. And the cutting, I mean, they just ran out of wood. It's a small island. And so in terms of trying to maintain human beings on, say, an island, the island's got to be a minimum size with a minimum diversity of species of life, and the population's got to be relatively low in order to keep that going. And people have to be sane. They can't get into wars and things like that, or disease that's going to make a problem. I mean, you put a bunch of people in a small enclosure, and you get a disease. And you know, the usual thing is, well, you isolate the people that are diseased. But if you've got a small enclosure, that becomes difficult. So then you run the risk of everybody getting sick and dying. Yes. Well, a lot of people have made that comment that maybe biosphere experiments would work if people weren't evil. But since people are, these experiments don't work. Well, we're not. But, I mean, there's plenty of unbelievers on the planet that think that our eternal salvation is going to reside in this universe. And what this paper shows is that if you're thinking the universe is going to be your permanent solution to humanity's problems, you got another thing coming. I mean, just dark energy alone is going to lead to an inevitable heat death of the universe that will make all life impossible. So just from that perspective, but of course that doesn't happen for a few trillion years. Well, my whole point is, only from a biblical perspective, you have a two-creation model. If you're talking Hinduism, Buddhism, or even for that matter, Islam, because the new creation in Islam is really a new creation that is described in a way that fits everything in this creation. And so only from a biblical perspective do you really have a radically different new creation with different laws of physics, different dimensionality, where evil and sin never exist again. And but in order for that to be possible, humanity must first go to school. And so, as I've likened in a few of my books, life here in this universe is like taking a tough college class. There's a lot of suffering involved. But it prepares you for something that you could not otherwise receive without that experience of suffering. And that's kind of the biblical message. God has us here in this universe to suffer. But that suffering has a very good purpose. And we're exposed to evil. Why? Because the evil has a very good purpose. It prepares us for a realm where evil will never exist again. And, you know, you can't really... I mean, God could put us in the new creation without evil if he made all of us robots. But if he made all of us robots, there would be no love. You know, God is love, and his goal was to create a creation where love could be magnified and glorified, and that's not possible unless people are first trained and educated. And that's kind of the message of the Apostle Paul in the epistles, that this life is a training program. We're in boot camp, and the boot camp prepares us for something we could not otherwise receive. And it prepares us for something that Adam and Eve could not have received either. Adam and Eve were in paradise, but they weren't tested. And because they weren't tested, there was also always a possibility that they could lose their secure relationship with their Creator. And you could argue it's simply a matter of time before either Adam and Eve or their descendants would lose that secure relationship. And proof of that is the angels. If it happened to the angels, it would have happened to humanity in one form or another. But God had set up his universe in such a way. That's kind of what I'm doing in my next book, by the way, is explaining how the physics of the universe brings about the most rapid and efficient conquest of evil and suffering. And, you know, look at all of us. We only have to live on this planet for 70, 80, 90, 100. The maximum, according to Genesis 6, is 120 years. So nobody has to put up with these conditions for more than 120 years. And yet that prepares us for an eternity where these conditions will never exist again. You're still alive. So that means the training is not yet finished. Right. The other thing we have is a message in 1 Corinthians 3, 15 to 20, or 11 to 15, pardon me, which tells us that when we complete our lives, during our life there is this sanctification process going on, where step by step we're delivered from the power of sin over us to persuade us to commit evil. So as we live a life under the control of Jesus Christ, every day, as it tells us in 2 Corinthians 4, we notice that these desires to commit evil have less and less power over us. So there's a maturation process that goes through our life. Nevertheless, we're all going to end our lives with things that would be like dirty laundry. And what it tells us in 1 Corinthians 3, 11 to 15, is that when God is done with his universe and has conquered evil and has removed evil, there will be a separation of humanity into two categories. And if you're in the category where you've given your life to the control of Jesus Christ and submitted to this process of his Holy Spirit day by day, cleansing you of this desire to commit evil, he says at that point he will burn up all your dirty laundry. And so you enter the new creation completely clean. Now, those who enter the new creation will not be punished for their evil deeds. The evil will simply be burned up and consumed. They'll be rewarded for what remains. So believers in the new creation won't get the same rewards. There'll be different rewards given to different people based on what they've accomplished in bringing glory to God in their lives. And as it warns us in the gospel accounts, what we think brings glory to God may not be what really brings glory to God. And a lot of us are in the business of trying to fulfill the will of God, not for our own life, but for someone else. You know, we Christians are good at that. Taking away other people's ministries instead of focusing on the ministry that God has given us, and will be rewarded to the degree that we have fulfilled the mission that God has given for each one of us. Which is why it's so critical in prayer to determine what it is that God has purposed for us to do. And, you know, I'm as guilty as the other one, doing things I shouldn't be doing and not focusing on those things I should be doing. But as the Holy Spirit works in your life, you gradually figure that out, and it's a maturation process. And as Paul points out, the incredible thing is it takes several years, or at least months, for your friends and relatives to look at you and notice that you're experiencing physical decay. I mean, you know, kind of what you do is you get out the old photographs and say, well, 3 years ago, you didn't have as much gray hair as you have today. But notice that it takes a significant period of time for you to notice that physical decay. But someone who's walking in the power of the Holy Spirit can see a change within 24 hours. And that's why Paul says we can rejoice in the physical decay of our bodies, because it in no way compares to the spiritual enrichment that takes place within each of us on a daily basis. So within a single day, you can see change. Whereas it takes a year to see the decay at the physical end, which is why it's so great to visit these saints who are in rest homes, who have been walking with the Lord for 50 years. Their bodies are completely shot, but there's a glow that comes on. And you just love to be in their presence. I've had that experience myself, and it really does testify what Paul speaks about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Now, does that kind of get to the bottom of what you're after? Maybe more than what you wanted to know. Okay. Well, there's no record within human history of a super eruption, but we do have records of super eruptions. For example, we can determine when the last super eruption occurred in the Mammoth Caldera. And we can also determine when the last super eruption occurred in Yellowstone. And there's one in Russia that they can determine. I'm trying to pull this off the top of my head. I think the last super eruption in Yellowstone was 70,000 years ago. And for Mammoth, you know, I can't wait, but we're talking less than 100,000 years. Okay. Well, we don't know the degree to which that might have impacted species of life. You know, in fact, there's been some attempts to try to say, you know, did one of these super eruptions terminate Homo erectus? Problem with that is we haven't got a good date for the termination of Homo erectus. And we do have a pretty decent date for Neanderthal. However, the Neanderthal population was already quite low when these things would have happened. And, you know, one of the things the article does point out, you're talking about getting a few human beings to survive at a Stone Age level. Maybe there's a possibility. But now you're really talking about the human race starting all over again. And if it took us 50,000 years to get where we are today, and one of these things happens every 50,000 years, that doesn't look good in terms of trying to claim that there's extraterrestrial intelligent civilizations elsewhere. Well, there's debate over whether the last Yellowstone super eruption was of this level. It may have been a little less than that level. Some have speculated that it wiped out everything on North and South America, but might have had a less devastating effect on Europe, Asia, and Africa. So, I mean, the definition here is 1,000 cubic kilometers of rocks and stones thrown into the atmosphere, and then 1 billion tons of dust thrown into the atmosphere. So, and they're still trying to figure out whether the last eruption of Yellowstone reached that magnitude. It came close, we know that much. So those are some of the unknowns we're struggling with. But one of the things this paper brings out is if you're talking about the minimum level of plate tectonic activity to make possible the equivalent of a human species, then this is the frequency of super eruptions you're talking about, given this definition. And given this definition, human civilization will not survive. it will be terminated by such an event. Yes. Well, I mean, the article actually talks about mass extinction events maybe being triggered by these things. And the only piece that it refers to is, because you know, it's hard to measure these animal mass size related extinction events. And the best data we have are mice and rats. And we do know that they suffer a mass extinction event about every 2 million years. Now, this is a lot more frequent than every 2 million years. But mice and rats are also a lot smaller than we are. In fact, some astronomers believe that the mice-rat extinction frequency is caused by a variation in Earth's orbit about the sun, rather than the super, because it says very regular. A little more than every 2 million years, we do see all the rats and mice disappearing. What's your... Well, I think I commented here a few months ago about this paper about mice and rats and how it raises the issue. How do you explain that these mice and rats come back? If you wipe them out that frequently, how do you explain them coming back? Well, Psalm 104 explains it. That's the property of all life to die off, but God recreates. He replaces the species of life that are driven to extinction with new species of life. And you could say, well, maybe he does that with something like Australopithecines or Homo erectus or Neanderthal. Maybe that's what's going on there. But it kind of defeats the atheist purpose because now you have to invoke this creator to explain all these replacements. And it's something we alluded to in our book, Who is Adam? The book I wrote with Fazal Rana. Namely that we anticipate that more bipedal primate species will be discovered in the fossil record rather than just the 10 they have found, 10 or 11 they have found so far. And this would document that we're looking at many different species coming and going of these creatures. So your question is a good one, but we don't have a definitive answer at this point, but maybe in 5 years we will. Right. Well, I'll tell you what the last paragraph of this paper talks about. It says, we need to be doing more research on super eruptions. And we've done all this study on comets and asteroids and what they're going to do to us, and yet we're ignoring a problem that is much more significant. So that's one thing they talked about, and they also said that maybe we need to be thinking about strategies to prepare ourselves for the next one. But they also concluded that we may discover that all those strategies are impossible. And they suggest that that may indeed be the case. They cannot suggest a rational way other than really spending a ton of money making a small artificial planet and maybe surviving that way. That's actually been seriously discussed, by the way, by the astronomical community of making a mini-Earth and putting it at the Lagrange point in the orbit of the Earth. So if anything bad happens to Earth, we can all escape to that. I'm wondering what that term means. Look at the orbit of the Earth. There are three points along the orbit of the Earth where you could have bodies where they wouldn't collide with one another in a short period of time. And so you could actually put a little space station out there. But you're talking about having human beings survive for a long period of time. You really do want it to be a mini artificial planet, which has some expense issues. Yeah. Well, yeah, you're thinking the right way if you're talking a mini eruption. If it's an eruption on this scale, it's going to provide a cover over the entire atmosphere. There's really, that's one thing they point out in the paper. There's nowhere you can run to on the surface of the Earth and survive. Everywhere you go, the Arctic, the Antarctic, Southern California, you're not going to make it. They said your only option is to go to outer space or go deep underground. Yes. Well, you're right. Well, okay, kind of what I'm doing in this book I'm working on is first making a point when you look at the issue scientifically, there's really no doubt that we are a privileged species. The design to make even our existence possible is, you know, very substantial. On the other hand, the conclusion that it's going to be suitable for human civilization tells us it's a very brief period of time. By the way, this is only one piece of evidence that demonstrates that the maximum longevity for human civilization can't exceed 40,000 years. And so we have here as a conclusion, the universe has been extraordinarily designed for the specific benefit of the human species, but designed to provide that benefit for a really narrow window of time. Which means if God's behind all this, then he must have a plan to bring things about his way in a short period of time rather than a long period of time. That's kind of the bottom line. Well, that's a common... Well, we know more than you may think. I mean, we have a pretty good idea of the sample size, at least within the observable universe. We're talking 50 billion trillion stars, with perhaps that many other planets that would accompany those 50 billion trillion stars. Well, that's only 23 zeros after the one. And when you contrast that with the fine-tuning that's necessary to bring about the conditions on which humans can exist. And right now we're looking in our calculations at 1,032 zeros after the one. And so the fact that you've got 10 to the 23 possibly existing planets, it may as well be zero. Those 23 zeros aren't going to help you one bit at all. From a naturalistic perspective, as many Christian scholars have pointed out, if God could perform a set of miracles to make it happen here on planet Earth, could not that same God perform another equivalent set of miracles somewhere else? Which now puts us into the theological camp. Is there any rational reason for God making two rather than one? Or God making 1,000 rather than one? Well, some Christian scholars argue that there is a good theological reason for God doing that. The reason being that if God made two and scientists discovered that second one, they would say, well, there's miracles not just here, there's miracles there too. And the more miracles you can prove, maybe the more evidence that you can give to skeptics to say there's a God out there that really loves you. On the other hand, there are scholars that say if God's primary purpose is to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil, how many planets does he need to make that happen? And the answer is he only needs one. If he only needs one, why would he bother with all of this other excess effort? Those are the first two chapters of this book I'm working on. And the bottom line is this. It's not possible to get a planet Earth unless you have 50 billion trillion stars. You need a universe with a very precise mass in order to have a planet Earth. Well, he can. Okay. You know why I'm working on this book? Because a lot of skeptics have made that argument, saying, well, okay, given the physics of the universe, naturally, he must make a universe this big for several different reasons. There's no way you're going to get a planet that can support physical life, given the laws of physics, unless the universe is truly enormous. And as I've said here in the class, if you were to take a single dime and add it to the total mass of the universe, or subtract it from the total mass of the universe, that's enough to disturb the balance. So we know it's got to be that massive. But skeptics have raised the question, then why these laws of physics? Couldn't God choose laws of physics where you don't need all those excess stars and excess planets, etc.? He could, but now he would have the wrong physics to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. And he would have the wrong physics for humanity having the capacity to observe the totality of cosmic history and discover that there's a beginning to the universe and a beginner beyond space and time. So given that God has at least 12 stated purposes for creating the universe, then that really does narrow his options down to one set of physical laws and one set of space-time dimensions in which those physical laws operate. However, what the Bible tells us is the moment that God conquers and removes evil, then we get a new creation with very different physics and very different dimensions. But evidently, this is the physics and these are the dimensions we need to bring about this rapid, efficient conquest of evil. Wait a year, it'll all be in my book. You had a comment? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a comment you see in Hebrews 10, that the creator of the universe came one time, one place, for all, which is an argument some scholars have given for why there's only one planet. God certainly has the power to make 1,000 planet Earths in this universe, or 1,000,000, but given that his whole focus is the conquest of evil, he only needs to create one. And as Hebrews 10 points out, the creator came to just the one planet, not to multiple. Well, okay. You know what's interesting about this whole debate about intelligent design? Is that the design is conceded by everybody. The atheists, the agnostics, the Christians, the Hindus, Buddhists, the Islamic scientists, they all concede, when we look at the universe, we see overwhelming evidence that it's been designed for life and especially designed for human life. They also concede, when we look inside the cell, we see all this evidence for design. Now, that's not the debate. The debate is, what is the cause of the design? And you have atheist scholars, for example, trying to say, oh yes, there's design in the universe, and there's design in the cell, and there's design in life, but it's accidentally caused. It's not purposely caused by a creator. And they recognize that the level of design in the universe is overwhelming. But they said, what if there's an overwhelming number of universes, all with different physical characteristics? Then we could argue that we happen to be living in the lucky universe, where the conditions are just right for life. Now, we've got a number of articles on this multiverse hypothesis that you can see on our reasons.org website. And one of the points we make is a simple point, you don't need to know a lot about physics, is that if there are these overwhelming number of universes in addition to our universe, there is no way we can test for that hypothesis or observe another possibly existing universe. And the reason for that is that the Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us that if there are multiple universes, and if you've got life in one of those universes, then the space-time envelope of that universe can never overlap the space-time envelope of any other possibly existing universe. Which means that this idea that there are other universes is not physics. It's metaphysics. And so this is in the theology department, not the physics department. And well, you can make that point too. But, you know, the first point we try to make in our papers is we need to appreciate this is not physics. Every multiverse model I've seen published in the literature reduces to a universe when you take out the metaphysical speculation. And so if it's metaphysical, then that means we're dealing with a theological issue, not a scientific issue. And therefore, it's quite proper to raise the questions the theologians do. Why would the universe be like that? Is there any rational reason why a no-creator model would produce that, or a creator model would produce that? Now, the second thing we've written about on our website is this, is that people who appeal to the multiverse as an explanation for the design of the universe are appealing to an actual infinity. And our whole point is, if you're going to argue philosophically, you've got to go with a countable number, not an uncountable number. In other words, tell us how many universes you need to make your hypothesis work. And don't tell us it's infinity times infinity. Give us a number that we can use. And give us a number we can put to the test. And then the final thing we write about is that all multiverse models, philosophically, are appeals to the equivalent of the gambler's fallacy. And I think I've discussed this in the class before. You know, where you take a coin and you flip it, and it always comes up heads. Even when you flip it 100,000 times, it comes up heads 100,000 times. Now, the person committing the gambler's fallacy would say, it's still a fair coin, because there is a possibility that a coin that is fair could produce 100,000 consecutive heads. After all, what if there are 2 to the 100,000 coins being flipped by 2 to the 100,000 people, 100,000 consecutive times each? The laws of probability tell us that one of the coins will come up heads all 100,000 times. Now, we call it the gambler's fallacy because the person making that kind of rationalization, number one, has no evidence that many coins exist. Number two, has no evidence that 2 to the 100,000 people are flipping those coins 100,000 consecutive times each, and has no evidence that all the coin flipping events are producing distinct results. One question I put to multiverse hypothesis proponents is this: who says all the universes have to be different? If they're all identical, you haven't gained a thing. Who says they must all be different? But finally, I would point out that in the case of the gambler's fallacy, you can always take that single coin. Forget about all the other coins. Take the single coin and look on both sides. If it's got heads on both sides, then there's no need for all that speculation. Or if you determine that the coin has been weighted in a special way, that even though it's got heads on one side and tails on the other, the law of gravity will guarantee it will always land up heads rather than tails. And again, no need for the speculation. Now, can you do that with the universe? We argue that we can. Astronomers can examine the universe in more detail than they've examined it so far. If the evidence for design for the benefit of humanity gets stronger rather than weaker, then we're quite proper in concluding that the gambler's fallacy is the wrong way to go. On the other hand, if the evidence gets weaker rather than stronger as we examine the universe in more detail, then we could say to the multiverse folks, maybe you've got a point. And so that's kind of the bottom line. I mean, what this says in the scientific literature is that the multiverse hypothesis is impossible to test. We dispute that. We say we do think it can be tested. Here's how you test it. Examine the one universe that we can measure in more detail. If the design evidence for the benefit of humanity goes up rather than down, then we can put the multiverse hypothesis to the rest. On the other hand, if it gets weaker, then we might say maybe the multiverse folks have got something going for them. And so I think that's the way you can settle that. But the whole bottom line is, you know, like this paper, it generates some discussion in the scientific community that otherwise would not happen. You know, one of my favorite quotes is still from Fang Liji, China's leading astrophysicist. He's an atheist, but he wrote in his book called Creation in the Universe, interesting title for a book written by an atheist. But the first point he makes in the book is, physics has now advanced to the point where we can determine questions about the origin of the universe that at one time were the sole property of those people doing research in the theology department. So he said what was a theological issue has now been made a scientific issue. By the way, that's not the exact quote. Go on our website to get the exact quote. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of things that can make life miserable for you. If a 10-kilometer asteroid hits the Earth tomorrow, then none of us will survive. That will be the end of any life form bigger than a shrew. So, yeah, and you say, well, how often does that happen? Well, it happens at least as frequently as every 50 million years. Say, well, how long ago since we had one of those? Well, 65 million years ago. We're overdue for one. But other astronomers point out that if a gamma ray burst were to happen in a relatively nearby galaxy, that would be a problem. However, the nice thing about gamma ray bursts, they only last for a minute or two or less. They're brief, which means it only obliterates a hemisphere. The other hemisphere will be fine. So if you're on the right hemisphere, you will survive. Yeah. Well, there's actually evidence in the fossil record for species extinction events that showed damage in one hemisphere, not the other hemisphere. And so there's a group of astronomers at the University of Arizona who are arguing that gamma ray burst events have had a significant impact on the extinction and speciation events on planet Earth. So, but, you know, that could happen, or if a supernova were to erupt, you know, a lot of people have made the comment that if Sirius goes supernova, we're in serious trouble. It's only 8 light years away. That's a bad joke, isn't it? Well, they have a sense of humor. I'm not saying they have a good sense of humor, but they do have a sense of humor. So I remember one time we were getting together with a bunch of astronomers and they were serving coffee. They had this really heavy cream that people put in their coffee. And I said, what are you guys drinking? Oh, we're making galaxy models. They had put the heavy cream in the coffee and then they'd stir it with a spoon and get a little spiral galaxy going.
Okay, what we did last week, just to give a quick review, we're going through the creation accounts in the Bible, and we're now into Psalm 33, one of the creation psalms. And just to give a quick review, it talks about the faithfulness of God in creating the universe, how he created the universe with the breath of his mouth, and the universe came into being. When God speaks, things happen. It gets into the details of God separating the surface of the earth into oceans and continents, and makes the whole point that when God changes things on the earth, he changes in a way according to his precise will. And, you know, nothing happens outside of his control. And then it makes the point that God does the same thing with people and with nations in human history. And often we human beings look at historical events and say it's total chaos. I mean, look at the 20th century. I mean, you had World War I, you had Adolf Hitler, you had Joseph Stalin, you had the Soviet Empire, you had what happened in China, Cuba. I mean, you look at the extinctions that took place in Cambodia and other parts of the earth that are still going on today, and you say, this is complete chaos. Well, Psalm 33 makes the point that as chaotic as world history may seem, it's all under the direct, precise control of the Creator. Nothing happens in terms of political events, social events, either with nations or with human beings, that is outside the control of God. And as one example of that, we went into Daniel chapter 9, 10, and 11, where, you know, Daniel is praying for 3 weeks, praying for wisdom. He says, look, I've been the prime minister of the Babylonian Empire, and the Babylonians have now been defeated by Darius the Persian, the Mede, and now I've been made the prime minister of the Persian Empire, but what about our people, the Jews? What's going to happen to our nation? And he prays for 3 weeks, and he fasts during those 3 weeks. Doesn't fast totally from food, but it tells in the text, he has no wine, he has no desserts, he has no special meats. For 3 weeks, he focuses on praying to God about the future of Israel. And an angel comes to him and says, look, we heard your prayer from the very first hour you started praying, but it took me 3 weeks to come to you because the king of Persia was opposing me, and made the point that there are angels that are not in league with the Creator. By the way, it's not just humans that are in rebellion. A third of the angels, we are told, are in rebellion against God. And these angels are at work to confuse human politics and human national affairs. So that's the first thing the angel tells Daniel. All this confusion you see going on in terms of human politics, the demons are behind it. But take heart. We angels who are in league with God are at war with those evil angels. And it says, I was delayed because I was involved in this particular conflict. But now I've come to you. My mission's been accomplished, and I've been free to come to you to tell you what will happen. And we spent a few weeks doing this, going through these three chapters of Daniel and noting the detail that it tells us about the intertestamental period. How often do you hear skeptics saying, you know, God has revealed us, himself to us through the Old and New Testament. Why is there a 400-year gap? I mean, the Old Testament ends at 400 B.C., and nothing picks up again until Jesus of Nazareth shows up at the beginning of the modern era. There's a 400-year gap. Well, you can actually look at Daniel 9, 10, and 11 and say there isn't a 400-year gap. Because in those three chapters, this angel comes and tells Daniel everything that's going to happen in that 400-year gap that's relevant to the nation of Israel. And we spent some time, but what we did is show you the detail in which this angel is able to foretell future events to Daniel. And how because Daniel, the book of Daniel, has now been found, at least in fragmentary form, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know it was the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court that wrote the book of Daniel, which means everything recorded in these three chapters are future events. This is God telling Daniel what will happen in the political affairs of the nations for the future. And notice what it said. It talked about how there would be four more Persian kings that would arise, and the fourth one would be the most powerful of all, but that God would raise up the Greeks. Well, actually would raise up this powerful Persian king to attack the Greeks, and attacking the Greeks would be defeated. And then how the Greeks would come and kind of take over the Persian Empire, but at the very height of the power of this Persian king, a reference to Alexander the Great, he would die in his youth at the height of his power, and now his kingdom would be broken up into four pieces, given to his generals. And then how these four different kingdoms, and particularly the two most powerful portions of those kingdoms, would fight one another for hundreds of years, and how finally the Romans would come in and put a stop to all of that. So there's your intertestamental period. Comment back here. Well, it is. Before the Dead Sea Scrolls, skeptics of the Bible looked at Daniel and said, this is an incredibly detailed depiction of historical events that obviously happened exactly as they were recorded in the book of Daniel. But they said, this is not evidence that the Bible is supernaturally inspired by the Holy Spirit. Rather, this is a Daniel that probably lived in the 9th century A.D., and some said the 5th century A.D. In other words, they tried to put the author of the book of Daniel living at such a late time in human history that they could say everything that's in the book of Daniel is simply hindsight. It's not foresight. Well, what put a stop to that was the fact that they found fragments of the book of Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls that carbon 14 analysis told us the book of Daniel must have been written previous to 200 B.C. And if it's previous to 200 B.C., then that means lots of the events recorded there were predicting future history because they happened after 200 B.C., but you could actually argue that's the case for all of them because if you're talking about a credible author of the book of Daniel and he's living before 200 B.C., then it's got to be the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. Because if there was some other fake Daniel that came up the contemporaries would be very easily able to expose it as a fraud. And the fact is that Daniel, the book of Daniel, has never been exposed as being fraudulent in that matter. And the whole point is, if there's only a couple of hundred years that have gone by since the events, it's really not possible for someone to come along and say, I am the Daniel Nebuchadnezzar's court without him being exposed as being a fraud. And therefore, scholars today, both liberal scholars and conservative scholars, do concede that Daniel was written by the Daniel of the court of Nebuchadnezzar and King Darius. Yes. Well, I think that's a good idea. Well, I'm hoping to get to that very point today. Well, that's what Paul said in 1 Thessalonians. Everything must be tested. We need to test God. We need to test ourselves. Everything needs to be tested. But you're raising a good point in the sense that, look what happened to the Jews in this century. And a lot of Jews reacted exactly as you described, saying, where is God? If there's a God, he would have rescued us. And he didn't. What happened? Well, what those Jews failed to do is to recognize all this was predicted in this book thousands of years ago. In great detail, it's exactly what was going to happen to the Jews in the 20th century. Huh? Okay. Read the book of Ezekiel. It'll tell you exactly why God did it. Now, I'll just read you a short passage. I mean, there's a lot more to it than this. Just take my word for it. We're going to get into this as to exactly what the Bible tells us about 20th century history. Just like Daniel predicted in great detail what would happen between 400 B.C. and 0, the Bible likewise tells us in great detail what was going to happen in the 20th century. And today we have the benefit of hindsight. The 20th century is gone. So we can look at the Bible, compare to 20th century events, and put to the test what it tells us in Psalm 33, where it says, God's in total control of historical events. Now, we're going to get into this, but let me just kind of get to your answer. Why God did all this? And it's in Ezekiel 36. He says, it is not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I'm going to do these things, but for the sake of my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations, where you have gone. I will show the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, the name you have profaned among them. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the sovereign Lord, when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. So it's making the point that God is going to perform, number one, some devastating consequences upon the Jews as a people, but that those consequences will lead to incredible blessings upon the Jews. And that God is doing all this not for the benefit of the Jews, but for the benefit of the observers of the Jews, the nations who are looking at the Jews and saying, look what happened to them. They were scattered for thousands of years through all the nations of the world, yet they survived. God protected them. And look what they did to the name of God, the way they profaned the name of God everywhere they went. Yet God did not wipe them out. And then when God blesses them, the nations again are going to look at this and say, how can this be? And again, he says, look, my real goal is the Gentiles. You know, God's going to reach the Jews, but he's using this to reach the Gentiles. And indeed, we're living in those days, and I believe we can document that God indeed is reaching the Gentiles. How so? I mentioned this last week. Figures from the U.S. Center for World Mission tells us that the number of Christians that could be defined as Great Commission Christians, motivated and committed to bringing the good news of Jesus Christ to all the nations of the world, numbered only 2% of the world's population in the year 1900, whereas today it numbers over 15%. So it's gone from 2%, and look how much the population has changed. In the year 1900, there were fewer than 2 billion people on the face of the earth. Today, there's 6.6 billion. Nevertheless, it's gone from 2% of the world's population to 15%. Because of what's happened in the 20th century, the Gentiles are being reached. And it tells us in the Bible that after the time of the Gentiles, the Jews will be reached. Now, we've got a few minutes left, so let me get into a little bit of this. And first of all, make the point that the dispersion of the Jews was predicted in great detail by none other than Moses. The Jewish nation wasn't even founded yet. And yet Moses said, let me tell you what's going to happen in the future. Okay, it's in Deuteronomy 28. And I'll just take you to the passage quickly here. Here we go. And he makes the point that God has given him this law. But the Jews of Moses' era were having a problem. They thought that the law, the Ten Commandments, was the way they were going to be blessed by God. And what Moses explains to them, look, God gave you these laws so that you would realize that you're sinners and are in need of salvation. He gave you these laws so that you would be persuaded that it's impossible to keep these laws in the way that God requires. And he says, but if you keep these laws, you'll be blessed. And the degree to which you keep these laws, you'll experience blessing. But if you reject these laws, there'll be curses that will come. And it makes a prediction that the Jews are going to do a really bad job of trying to please God through the law. And therefore, they'll suffer consequences. It says, the Lord, verse 36, will drive you and the king you set over you to a nation unknown to you or your fathers. So it's making a specific point that God first will judge the Jews by casting them out of their land and having them sent to a nation unknown to them or their fathers. Verse 47, because you did not serve the Lord your God joyfully and gladly in the time of your prosperity. And I underline that because I think there's a message here for us. We Americans are living in a time of our prosperity. If God judged the Jews, why will he not judge us? Because you did not serve the Lord your God joyfully and gladly in the time of your prosperity, therefore hunger and thirst and nakedness and dire poverty, you will serve the enemies the Lord sends against you. The Lord will bring a nation against you from far away, will lay siege to all the cities throughout your land, verse 52, until the high fortified walls in which you trust will fall down. He'll besiege all the cities throughout the land the Lord your God is giving you. And that actually happened. When Nebuchadnezzar came into the land, he laid siege to all the cities of Judah, conquered all those cities, brought down all those walls, brought down the walls of Jerusalem. And what did he do? He took all the Jews that were living there and took them captive to his land in Babylon. However, he goes on in his sermon to say that in spite of that judgment, the Jews have become even more despicable in their capacity to serve and worship the Lord, and therefore God would judge them a second time. And he says, then the Lord will scatter you among all the nations, not just one nation, but all the nations, from one end of the earth to the other. There you'll, what verse? Okay, I'm all the way down to 64. Yeah, I'm jumping around. It says, you'll be uprooted from the land you're entering to possess. So here they are. They come back from Babylon. They're back in the land of Israel. But he says, you'll be uprooted again. And this time you'll be scattered to all the nations. Among those nations you'll find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary and longing, and a despairing heart. You will live in constant suspense, filled with dread, both night and day, never sure of your life. Because of the terror that will fill your heart and the sights that your eyes will see, the Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt on a journey I said you would never make again. There you'll offer yourself for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but no one will buy you. Now, I'm going to try to rush this through, but the book of Hosea has got an interesting comment. Let me just quickly get to the book of Hosea here. Here we go. Hosea, the Lord said to me, chapter 3, for the Israelites will live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or idol. Afterwards, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God in the last days. They'll come trembling to the Lord, to his blessings in the last days. But it's making the point here that this second rebuke by God will last a very, very long time. They'll be scattered amongst the nations for a long time. Hosea picks up the theme again in chapter 6, verse 2, where it says, after 2 days, he'll revive us. On the third day, he'll restore us. And I've actually used this in debates with younger creationists to make the point, here is a text where days are numbered, where they're not 24-hour days. In fact, you could argue we're talking days that are about 1,000 years apiece. Because indeed, the Jews were without a king, without a ruler, for about 2,000 years. But now they have their own government, their own nation, in the land of Israel. Now, the point here is that here's Moses writing 3,400 years ago, 3,500 years ago. And he prophesied in great detail the events of these dispersions. I can tell you what happened in history. Let me give you one more text. One more text, New Testament. This is Luke 21. Okay. Jesus is speaking to his disciples. And the disciples are asking him a question. When will the temple be destroyed? And he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you'll know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out. Let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment and fulfillment of all that was written. And Jesus here is referring to Deuteronomy 28, Moses, his last sermon, and referring to the book of Hosea. He says, this has already been written about. This is going to happen. He says, there will be great distress in the land and wrath against his people. They will fall by the sword. They'll be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Again, referring to that 2,000-year period when the Gentiles ruled over Jerusalem rather than the Jews. Now, this is what history records. That the Roman Empire finally had it with the Jews because there was a rebellion that rose up in the late 60s AD, about a generation after the time of Jesus of Nazareth. And that's what Jesus said, within a generation, this will happen. This beautiful temple you look at, all of its stones will be cast down. The city will be trampled. This will happen within a generation after my leaving. And indeed, within a generation, 70 AD, here's the Titus coming in with his armies, and he does exactly that. He destroys the city of Jerusalem, destroys the temple, takes it down so you can't have even one stone on top of one another. Then he gathered up all the Jews that he could find in the land of Israel, put them in ships, sent them to Egypt, and in Egypt he sold them as slaves throughout the entire Roman Empire. And because there were so many millions of Jews that were taken that way, the price of the slave dropped to such a point where they had to give away these Jewish slaves. Now, the price got that low. Who said it first? Well, Moses, writing 1,400 years previous to the event, said this is what's going to happen to you. And you'll remain in all these nations for many, many generations, and then God will bring you back. Now, I say all this because before the 20th century, there were a number of people who said, okay, What evidence can you give us that this God of the Bible is a God that's in control of human history? What this, and you can see this in the textbooks. They said, the best evidence that we can provide is the survival of the Jew. That's a miracle. There's never been a people group that has been scattered to that degree and persecuted to that degree that maintain their national identity, their language, their culture, their religious system. Whenever it happened to any other people group, they either got assimilated or their culture disappeared, or the people disappeared. I mean, look at the Edomites. They're gone. The Ammonites are gone. The Moabites are gone. The Jews, they survived all this. But it was all prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago. Now, we haven't got time. Next week, we're going to cover this. The Bible also predicts in great detail exactly how the new nation of Israel would be established. Its name, where they would settle first, how the nation would grow. Very interesting prophecy that it makes. You'll find in the book of Ezekiel that when the nation is formed, a nation to the east from the old land of Edom would come in and take away all the ancient high places of worship of the Old Testament and would make it their own land. But in time, the Jews would take possession of all those ancient high places. Let me just show you one overhead I've got here. Those of you who heard were in this class 32 years ago will have already seen this. There you go. You can kind of take the light. So some of you actually remember this, right? Well, I repeated it a couple of times. Okay. That one. But this is a map that shows all the Old Testament ancient high places of worship. These little green crosses. And Mount Zion, Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. You've got the Mount of Olives here. You've got Samaria, all the ancient high places. And at the time of the establishment of Israel, the most powerful army amongst the Arabs was the army of Jordan. And the Jordanians came in and said that they were going to conquer this land and make it a Palestinian state. That was their stated goal, and the Palestinians supported them. But you know what happened after the 48 war? The Jordanians thumbed their nose at the Palestinians and said, we're going to make this part of our land. Well, Ezekiel 36 and 37 predicted that thousands of years ago, that the old nation of Edom would come in and take possession of those highlands, that ancient high places of worship, and make it their own land, but they would not keep them. Then in due time, the Jews would come in and take them. By the way, in the 48 war, the Jews tried mightily to take at least one of those high places. They wanted one for their Jewish worship, but they were not successful in taking even one of those ancient high places. The Edomites, or the old nation of Edom, had the whole lot. Now, is this little border here simply an accident? I don't think so. Okay, come next week, we'll tell you a whole lot more about this. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that we're living at a late enough time in human history when we can go through your book, the Bible, and document that indeed you are in total control of every event in human history. And Father, often we ponder the reasons why. All the killing, the death, the disease, the conflict amongst different human nations. Lord, I pray that you would give us insight into your book, that we may be able to gain your perspective as to why the good that you're bringing about through all these very confusing events, seemingly confusing events in human history. And Lord, thank you for revealing to us that this isn't just for the benefit of us human beings, but you're also doing this for the benefit of the angels. And you are bringing about this incredible conquest and removal of evil and suffering. And so, Lord, I pray you continue to give us insight so that we may understand and give us opportunities to share that understanding with people that don't know you yet, as a Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.